ask about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Bob Popovics, and he'll be answering your most important questions on saltwater fly design techniques. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Bob a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Bob Popovics about saltwater fly design techniques. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at, as Dave Whitlock puts it, the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Bob, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. So now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Bob's section that says click here to register for the drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Bob's book, Fly Design, Techniques, Insight, and Patterns, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And to find out more about the other books that Stackpole has to offer, go to stackpolebooks.com, stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Bob and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win Bob's book. Our guest tonight is Bob Popovics. Bob is the founder of the Atlantic Salmon Saltwater Fly Rodders, advisory member of TFO Rods, a member of the Renzetti Legacy Tying Team, associated with Tibor Reels and a Freshwater Hall of Fame and Catskill Fly Fishing Museum Hall of Fame inductee. Though he has refined his fishing techniques and casting skills by traveling around the world, Bob is perhaps best known as a designer of lies, or flies as they're called, and as a teacher. Starting with his famous surf candy pattern in the 1970s, Bob's innovative fly tying concepts helped pave the way for modern-day saltwater fly fishing in the Northeast. His epoxy and silicone flies were the first of their kind, and anglers around the world continue to tie, fish, modify, and study Bob's creations, many of which were included in his best-selling 2001 book, Pop Flies, co-authored with Ed Jaworski. A patient teacher, Bob has helped countless tires and anglers through his seminars, videos, and writing. Though Bob's specialty is fly fishing in the surf on his favorite northeastern beaches, his famous patterns like the Silicone, Bullhead Deceiver, Bob's Ranger, and Hollow Fly have been adapted for a wide variety of fishing situations in fresh and salt water around the world. Bob and his wife Alexis own and operate the Shady Restaurant in Bayville, New Jersey, and live in Seaside Park, New Jersey. Bob, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Trust me.
Yeah, well, great. Good to have you. Been meaning to do this for a long time, and we're finally here, so let's do it, huh?
All right, I'm ready, man.
Right.
What do you got for me here?
Well, first of all, I want to share with folks a little of your background. You know, when did you first start tying flies? What got you interested?
Well, a lot of people I know in normal conversation I would have from time to time, they're generally taken back by the fact that I did not get started in fly fishing until I came back from Vietnam. So I was 21 years old when I first had a fly rod in my hand. I had always been fascinated by the fly rod. I always would be able to picture that line rhythmically sliding through the air in that typical shape of the loop. But I didn't get started till I was, you know, relatively late. I did not do it as a child, as a young boy, or whatever. But it was 21 years old. I got back from Vietnam. A couple of buddies came by, and we went fishing, and we were just doing simple jigging, fishing deep with conventional tackle for weak fish along the Jersey Shore. And as we were doing that, a school of bluefish came towards the boat on the surface, and they started to pull out fly rods, and I said, I would love to do that. And in their joking way, they said, well, you're not going to learn now because they're going to try to do it, and it wasn't the time for me to learn. But good for them, they came back to my house the next day and then took me to a tackle store, Cap Colvin's Tackle Store in Seaside Park, where I got my first fly rod, reel, line, and my first casting lesson by Cap Colvin out in front of his shop in Seaside Park. So that's how I started. It was late, and it was at least a year later that I finally decided to tie my own fly. So that's the beginning.
And you started right away with saltwater flies?
Yes, I right into saltwater. Broken in the Atlantic surf, and then of course we also got where we do a lot of wading in our bay areas, but it's another challenger because we wade fairly deep, you know, up to your just below your wader tops, and it was quite the challenge. Always windy, and then I didn't cast the first fly onto a trout for a few years later, and even when the first I fished with Ed Jaworowski, and he took me to this place that had a lot of trout in it. It was really heavily stocked, and it was a great place for a beginner to go. And then when I would catch a trout, I used to yell to him. I said, what kind of trout is this? And he would tell me, that's a brown trout, or that's a rainbow. You know, I wouldn't even know. I was just so strongly saltwater oriented, but I loved it. I really, really loved it. And the other fish, too, but, you know, you're making me recall way, way back. Another fish that we did in the off-season here along the Jersey Shore was fly fish for pickerel. We had beautiful pickerel ponds and everything. So that helped pass the time away because, you know, once I started in, that was August, you know, fish through the fall, and then wintertime would come. Our seasons were over by middle of November, so they had all the rest of November, December, January, February, March, wait till the spring would come. The season would open in March 1st, and then that wouldn't get started for about a month later. And then, you know, there was a lot of downtime, and I'm jonesing, and I want to go get some more of this fly fishing stuff. And pickerel fit the bill fairly well. So, that was the beginnings of it.
Yeah, and I assume that when you first started fly fishing, you were buying flies and so forth. So is there any person or what inspired you to actually start tying?
Now, in the beginning, I was bumming flies just like everybody else, and I say that to people all the time. In the beginning, just get all the flies you can from your friend until you want to get into tying. And the guy who really helped me more than anyone was my best friend. His name is Butch Colvin. That was Cap Colvin's son. And he came to my house one night. It was my birthday, which is November the 17th. Okay, that following year. And another thing that he was very interested in and got me interested in was hockey. I never played hockey as a kid, always baseball, football. But hockey, I used to love it, but I couldn't follow the puck. And he says, well, I'm going to show you how to do this, and we'll teach you. And he says, okay. So he comes over to my house. It's my birthday, and he comes in. He knocks at the door, which was unusual. He didn't have to knock at the door to come in my house. He could just walk in. But I go to the door, answer the door, and as I open the door, I see him standing there, and with him he has a cardboard flat with a vise, bobbin, bucktail, thread, and feathers in it. And I knew what it was for, but I said, hey, he says, happy birthday. You're going to learn how to tie flies. I said, Butch, I can't do that. Look at these hands. And I'm a big man. So I said, I can never have the dexterity to do that. He says, oh, yes, you're going to learn between the periods of the hockey game. And I did. And I can still remember to this day very vividly, honest, Roger, when I would put the hook in the vise, it was, and I still have the vise. It's an old cast iron, I don't know, whatever that is. It was an old one. And I put the hook in, and now I have this rod wrapping thread in a bobbin. And I'm trying to capture the thread along the shank. And, of course, a lot of the guys in the beginning, they know how that slides back and forth until you catch it. The moment, the instant that I was able to capture the thread, cross over onto it, and then it would no longer slide, and then I could feel the tension, I just felt, even at that time, I was doing something that I was going to like. And then, then from there, it was just, I would tie for nights on end.
Yeah, it's always interesting to find out how people start, you know. I mean, I got started from a next-door neighbor, you know, that father of two younger boys than we were, but we were in junior high school. And he was teaching my friend, and who lived on the other side of him, and the both of us would go over there, and he'd get us started. And I still remember the first fly I tied. It was a mosquito, and I took that out and caught a largemouth bass with it on a pond by a.
No kidding. See,
you know,
there you
go.
You
remember
and you're
those
done.
Things? Yeah. And
yes.
It's like, gosh, why would I remember that? But it was real significant to create something and then catch something with it.
And you can really remember it very vividly, too. That's what's really crazy about it. It's almost like you can almost relive it.
Yeah.
It's so vivid.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But that's what got you going. Okay.
And
then, you know, what, I mean, you're really well respected in the fly fishing world for saltwater flies and your innovations and so forth. Was that a gradual thing that evolved, or?
It's interesting. I think I never was what would be considered creative any time during my life at that time. And when I was learning, I would make the most crude-looking flies you ever saw. But what was funny, I would have a whole bunch of these. I didn't have very good materials. I had bucktails, and then I would buy feathers in a universal vise rack in a store. It was a spindle thing, and they would have them in little plastic sleeves, five feathers, and they would be short and stubby, squatty, like, you know, they were not saltwater type feather stream for streamers, for saltwater streamers for sure, but they were feathers. So I would take anything I could find, and I would make these, the ugliest of all tarpon streamers, and then I would make them, and I would lay them down on the floor, on the rug, and I would watch TV, and I'd have all these flies, maybe 24 of them, all laying on the floor, and I'd look at them. Little did I realize that what I was doing probably at the time was actually criticizing each one individually. One, this one looks better than that one. Why? Well, oh, yeah, this tail rolled, this feather rolled, this hackle. I didn't keep it nice and tight while I was palmering it. Maybe I spread it open too much. You know, things like that. I didn't realize it, but they were crude as could be. And I remember hanging them on my Christmas tree the whole nine yards. Well, that didn't happen anymore once I got some pretty good material. And I was able to get some good material a little bit later. And I noticed right away that even though I was tying the same, because I had better material, the flies really looked a little bit better. As a matter of fact, much better. And then guys would always say, hey, Bob, why don't you tie these flies, these deceivers or whatever I was doing at that time. I had got a book by Ken Bay, which was my Bible as far as fly tying was concerned. You know, I would just go page by page, one step on one page in that book. I really, really loved it. And I would practice it through the nights and all that. And it was really, really important for me. And I started to get better at it. but that still didn't bring out any creativity. Where that came, I would went through passages, and I could see it in other tires as they get started even today. The first thing they try to do, which I also did myself, was try, okay, wow, I'd like to be able to design a fly that I could put my name on. I think almost everyone, especially when they're young, you kind of want to do that. Well, that was a total failure. If I couldn't, it just didn't make any sense to me even. It wasn't until I had a reason to say, I got to solve a problem. And then that was when the creativity kicked in. It wasn't so much really, I guess, creativity. It was the ability to solve problems. So I would say, now, the perfect instance would be the surf candy, the use of epoxy. I used to have epoxy on my fly tying bench when I used to make Kaboom Boom poppers, which were perch cork floats that we'd cut in half, and we would make saltwater poppers out of it. Unfortunately, they didn't last very long, but I used 5-minute epoxy to glue the hook inside the popper. And so there it is on my desk, and I would finish Brooks Blondes. I would tie a bunch of them for bass and bluefish, and I would coat them instead of with head cement. I would coat the head with 5-minute epoxy. Now here we go. I start fishing for bluefish. I'm fishing in the surf. School blues come right down, and I catch one. Boom, get him off. The fly's starting to get a little bit ratty. I get one more. By the time I got that fly out of the second fish's mouth, it was destroyed. It happened again and again and again. And then I started to realize, you know, I would say to the guys that, doggone bluefish, they're chewing my flies up. He says, well, that's what you get when you fly fish for bluefish. I said, I don't know. There's got to be a better way. Now, there comes, I look at my old flies that are all beat up, and I would see the thread head would be perfect. Still, it could even have a couple of scratches on it, but the head was still there. The bucktail was gone. The shank part was gone with the mylar and the other tie of bucktail. They were beaten up and gone. But that head was always in good shape. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to stop that epoxy at the thread now. I'm going to carry that. I'm going to hold these fibers back, and I'm going to put epoxy on that whole thing. And I did. And I said, I got to make it so that it looks like a fish. I didn't just want to let it stand up and just apply epoxy around. I pulled the fibers back, applied a heavy amount of epoxy on it, and that worked. Nobody liked it. They thought it was ugly as hell because, don't forget, now you have the waves in the epoxy. In the fibers of the bucktail. You pull them back, the epoxy goes in, settles in towards the center, and then they leave a lot of these little bumps exposed, so it was very crude looking. But I would catch fish, and I would catch more than one or three or five or seven on one fly and not have it destroyed. Yeah. So that was the birth of the surf candy. That was really my first one, and that was a problem solve, and I learned a big lesson there.
Yeah,
that's how that came.
That's interesting because the last show we did was a fly tire out here, very well known in the trout world, Charlie Craven, and he's got his name on. I don't know how many flies, but he said the same thing. I told him, I said, hey, I really like that fly you tied because designed because last week I caught a whole boatload of fish on that fly, and he goes, well, you know, that was that. I developed that to solve a problem. And he says, I was trying to get a nymph down quickly. And none of my nymphs were doing what they needed to do, so I tied that to solve the problem. And he says, all his successful flies came about in the same way, as you just described.
Same here. I agree with that.
Roger,
the thing was, I used to, then I would get ideas, and they were starting to come through my mind like it was crazy. It would wake me up in the middle of the night and all that. There was a rush of all these different new ideas and problem solves. But I, you know, later on, if we would move forward a bunch of years, now it's starting to get a lot of notoriety, and then articles are being written, and then people started looking for the next one. And I had, you know, Ed Jaworowski used to do all the writing of the articles. I don't like to write, and I never wrote, so he would have to do all the articles. And he said, do you have anything else? I said, no. I said, I can't. I'm not just going to make something for the sake of making something different. It doesn't work that way for me. And I had to resist that temptation. And, you know, I felt like, oh, God, I don't want to disappoint anybody, but there's nothing to do here right now. I have no problems that I have to solve at this time. But, of course, they would come in time. But it wasn't, you know, you just don't sit at a device and say, let's make something different. And it doesn't work that way.
Right. Well, there's Bob Gillespie in Sioux City, Iowa, wrote in, and he said, Lefty Craig called you the most innovative fly tire he had ever known. And he asked, if you had to name one thing, how did this occur? So would it be problem solving? Was that the, is that the?
You know, I don't know. I never understood. Lefty is like a father to me, as he is to so many others. But he truly is. I've known him for over 40 years. And I think what he refers to probably most proudly, I just hear in his conversation, is new techniques. He says, every time I would see you, you'd had something new to show me. And I think that's kind of it. I mean, and I can remember showing him almost all the flies from the Surf Candy to this real, was really big one, which was my next one, which was a big bunker fly, which now is really the, we're back to the beginning and now a little bit further now with the Beast. But there was a fly that I made called the Big Bunker Fly that I used two vices on monofilament to get the fly to be very large. That was way back in the 70s. That was another one he saw, he just went crazy over. And then just different things. I think his reason for that is because it's the different techniques. It's not just taking a pattern and tweaking something. It's about something totally onto a different path, kind of the thing. Yeah. I think that's what he's referring to there. I really don't know. That's a question if someone should ask Lefty. I never have, but but I think that's what he calls. If I, you know, different conversations we've had or correspondence that we've had, he seems to mention that a little bit. And I think that's the criteria, I guess, that I meet for him. Okay.
Interesting. Well, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about fly design. So hang tight here, Bob, and we'll be right back.
Yes, sir.
The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, in the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bob Popovics about saltwater fly design techniques. If you'd like to ask Bob a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Bob, I know you told me you were shucking oysters earlier tonight, but when you get a chance to go fly fishing, you know, what's going on up there in your world?
Well, this is along the Jersey Shore. We're not a destination for a lot of our fish, for striped bass and bluefish, because they're migratory. And they're going from south to north, and we're a spot somewhere in between. So we see them when they're on their way, either coming up, going north, or coming south in the fall. They come up in the spring, south in the fall, and that's where we're waiting for. Right now we're kind of in between. We're getting a little bit more encouraged because it is middle of August. Water temperatures in time. Right now they're not going to cool up very much because it's so hot. But soon enough, that will start to change, and the winds will be a little bit more predominant out of the northwest, and that seems to get things moving. But right now, we're kind of sitting tight, but guys just a little bit north of here through the Montauk, Long Island, or Rhode Island and Massachusetts and Maine, they're starting to see some pretty good fishing now. They're just starting to get inundated with either bonita or false albacore, some striped bass showing, still have some bluefish up there. And they'll be staying there for a while, then they're going to start to migrate down. So you see this starts in September, October, November, December. By December, middle of December, even around Christmas, we're still catching striped bass up here in Jersey, or down here in Jersey, I should say. But the guys in Massachusetts had been stopped for about a month already.
Yeah.
Okay, so right now we're in that wait. We're in the in-between time, but things look good. We're all encouraged, and we're excited about the new season, as we usually get every year. So,
do you primarily fish in the surf, or do you use a boat?
No, I primarily do it in the surf. I live along the shoreline. I have a four-wheel drive van that I take on the beach. It has my rods in it and everything, and a lot it holds my camera gear, my video gear. I like to do that as much as anything else. And I love the surf. I've been fascinated with the surf ever since I was a little kid. I used to come down with my father, and, you know, we used to catch bluefish and striped bass and things, and he was always a big fan of the surf, even though, of course, he was a big boat fisherman, but primarily, it was something when people caught a fish in a boat was ho-hum. But if somebody down the shore caught one on the surf, then it was he started calling his buddy, saying, hey, we got to get down to the beach. It was exciting, and it still is. It's a very unique place to fish. You're kind of restricted. We do have the shoreline where we're standing on terra firma, or we're on rock jetties or walls and inlets, but, you know, whereas in a boat, you can go out and go get them. Here, we have to hope that they get close enough to us to reach. And yeah, it's quite a challenge. So, and in that challenge is a lot of reward.
Yeah, yeah. I have a, since we're just talking about that, we'll come back to the flies, but just to answer one of our listeners' questions he wrote in here.
Sure.
Deals with fishing in the surf. So let's see if we can address a couple of these quickly.
Okay.
Bill, he's down in Kentucky. He says, saltwater fly fishing presents some casting challenges that folks on small streams don't face. What are the casting challenges that folks fishing on the New Jersey coast face, and what tips might help people improve?
Well, the first thing is the wind. Okay, I think that would be pretty obvious for anybody because you're in a wide open space, and there is no a lot of times there's nothing to get behind to get for to save against the wind. So you have to learn how to deal with it. And the first thing that was taught to me about wind is make the wind your friend. So you try to use it to your advantage. But then sooner or later, you're going to have to deal where if the wind is in your face and you have to cast into that wind, you're just going to have to do that. You're going to have to learn how to deal with it. And there are times, you know, it takes time. It is a very big challenge, and that's why that's one of the things why I like it so much, because I always like the challenge. I like to get onto a more level playing field with the fish, but the surf it's very windy most of the time, not always. Another thing that they really have to practice. I'm sorry?
Well, before you go on, how do you, if you have to cast into the wind, what do you do differently than your
okay, well, you
cast
have to learn
down.
To... Well, you have to manipulate the line. You have to be able to control your loops, okay, to where the only thing that's going to drive into that wind is a nice tight loop, okay? It's all according to the level that you want to do it. Now, I'll do it up into a storm with 40-knot winds, all right? That's the truth. But that's very restrictive, and I have to do things only at a certain time in a certain place. That's a long, long story. But in the beginning, even just a slight wind that's in your face becomes a problem to a guy in the surf. So if he can learn how to cast into the wind, that's what's going to get him out of it. By doing that, he's going to have to learn to control the size of his loops, get nice tight loops to drive it into the wind. And what happens a lot of times, as soon as people have the wind in their face, they try to drive the rod too hard. and they smack the rod tip down. The tip goes down, bounces down, the loop opens up, and then boom, the fly line doesn't go anywhere. But if they can maintain and not be intimidated by the wind and just believe that a good, sharp, a brisk stop is going to tighten the loop enough that it's going to slide it right through that wind pretty good, that's what they have to learn. It's practice is the only way that you can get against it. But there are techniques, and it's all about being able to cast with controlling your loops to get them as small as possible. Now, another thing that the one thing that I've always been involved in is trying to eliminate the frustrations to get guys that would gentlemen would leave too soon because they would be too frustrated. One of the things that I remember when I started, they did not use stripping baskets in the surf. They didn't use them wading either. In the surf, you have the fly line under your feet. It's getting tossed around by the waves. The sand is real fluid underneath you, and you're getting tangled. Before you know it, you go to try to make a cast, and it just doesn't go in that direction. It's nothing but a mess. It's totally frustrated. Where if they use a stripping basket, that eliminates that problem. They don't have to practice anything. They just have to do it. Mm-hmm. Even when you're wading in deep water and you have strong wind, if you're using a floating line, that fly line starts to float further and further apart away from you, and then it's hard to get distance on your cast because all the drag as that excess line has to come off the water to go through the guides. So again, the stripping basket makes all the difference in the world there. But when you can, you try to use the wind if it's to your back or to your side. You use that wind to try to help carry the line into the surf or whatever where you're towards your target. Another thing I know a lot of people talk about too, Roger, is when they get into surf, they always say, well, the waves, I make my cast, and the waves pick my fly line and throw it right back at my feet. Okay, there's another very simple solution on that. In the surf, it's white water that will carry your fly line, especially a floating line, and dump it right back onto the beach. The key is don't cast when you see white water coming in. There's always lulls in waves, 1, 2, 3, 4 waves, and then there's a lull. And it's as that last wave comes in of the first set, you make your cast. That lands in a flat water. You can strip it before the next set of waves come in. And that way you get a controlled retrieve for the whole length of line you're casting. So
very good tip.
We got a lot of tricks there, Roger, but it's a lifetime of tricks. So yeah. we'd need a couple more hours here.
But it's
persistence. Use a stripping basket. Take your time. Don't get frustrated. Know firsthand that it's going to take a little time. And, you know, as everything that I've ever been involved in, when I do something new, that's when I have the most fun. So now, don't run away from it because it's hard. It's that beginning, and when you're first learning something new, that's the best time of all. That's the most fun you're going to have. Don't run away from it. Accept it. Right.
Yeah. Is there any kind of a particular kind of stripping basket you recommend? Do you have your own?
No. Well, you can make one. Get a regular dish pan from Rubbermaid, a little bungee cord. That was the first ones that I had. Or you can get them at Orvis or TFO has one. They got a beauty.
Yeah.
They're worth it. Really worth it.
Yeah. And Phil has a follow-up question here, and then we'll get back to flies.
Okay.
He says, fishing the Jersey coast, what recommendations can you give about speed of retrieve, depth of the fly is running out, and other presentation issues that you're dealing with? So you've just made the cast in the flat water there. Is there any, particular thing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I'll tell you, he's got some good ones there. The key is trust your instincts. As the fisherman, and then, as you know, with fly, with conventional tackle, you have one lure and one line. The lure goes where the lure is designed to go, either on top water, mid water, just below the surface, or towards the bottom. And the fly line, or the line, doesn't change. If he changes to another lure, the line stays the same. With us in fly fishing, it's our fly line, it's the length of our leader, We have to manipulate all that to zero in exactly what level we want it to go to. Then all of a sudden you get a cross current. The current will lift the fly higher than it normally would be without current. So you have to be aware of all these things. Observe. Watch. Be a good fisherman. You have to, you know, like the retrieve. Sometimes fast retrieve are good. Sometimes you don't want any retrieve at all. Let it go into the current and let that fly swim. Sometimes you need a stop-and-go type retrieve. Okay, there's a lot of things. That's why I say trust your instincts. Be a fisherman. You have to manipulate. It's like hand lining. Fly fishing to me is nothing more than hand lining, except we have a fly rod in the way, and we have to get our cast out with that fly rod. And you just manipulate with your hand. You manipulate your fly with the speed, a little bit of twitch here or whatever, and you have to fish. You have to be the fisherman.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I hear you talking like that, you could have just as well described somebody nymph fishing or streamer fishing in a Colorado stream. Because you're
That's
dealing
right.
with the same things, right? The water's
yes,
moving.
Yes.
It moves differently, but you're going to fish in different places. You're not going to fish in a rapid. You know, you're going to fish in a calmer area. And it's again, reading the water and understanding what your fly is doing underneath it and at what depth you're at and all the same things. It's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why, like, if you had somebody coming in for the first time with a spinning rod and put a Rapala on there, and you could say, here, just cast that, or just reel it about this speed. They'll do the same exact thing every cast, and they're going to catch a fish here or there, okay? But with fly fishing, it's different. You can't just say, cast out there, retrieve like this. That's not what fly fishermen do. You're in touch. We have the fly line. We have the line in our hands, not on a piece of wood. Or it's not on a metal reel. It's being pulled in by hand. You feel the line.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's hand. I think it's beautiful, actually. So, that's how you fish. You have to be a fisherman.
Okay, Joe in Sicklerville, New Jersey. I don't know if you know where that
is. Oh, yeah.
Okay. He says, I realize all the factors that go into fly design are important. So, in your approach to fly design, how do you rank the following factors in order of importance? Size, color, shape, silhouette?
Well, size, shape, and silhouette are pretty much around the same, kind of mean the same, but the first thing for me is shape. When I'm looking for design, if I want a fly that has a nice taper to it, I have to design the taper in the fly. Okay, so I have to be able to see. When I sit in front of my vise and I put my hook in there, I've decided what hook I need to use. I put that in the vise, I can see the fish that I'm trying to imitate on that hook. I can see it. And then I start to place materials in wherever they belong or how much or whatever, and I can create the shape by doing that as I go up of the shank of the hook. So size and shape, I mean, well, the size, this fly will look exactly like another one, but one's bigger than the other. Okay, so size is important. The shape I've already captured. Now I got to make them in the lengths that I need. Okay? Color is the least of my concerns, especially here in salt water. The fish are fast. They're aggressive feeders. They don't sip. You know, they pretty much aggressively go and chase bait down and attack it. They're far bigger than the bait that they eat, and not a challenge for them. So I try to imitate the shape. And if it's a bigger bait, I'll put on any kind of identifiable features that I can on any bait. But generally, the bigger baits I put less on, and I just worry about the size and shape. Some flash, not too much, not too little. Okay, some not at all. Some have eyes on them, some don't. All right, these are the bigger baits, from mullet all the way up to bunker and herring, big herring. But when you go to smaller baits now, smaller baits, the smaller they are, I mean down to an inch or three-quarters of an inch to maybe 3 inches, those baits generally are clear. The flesh on them is clear. Now, what happens is the belly sacs stand out. They have a silver stripe along the middle of the belly. It's going to stick right out. The eyes stick right out. They are basically, that's all you see when the fish is underwater. You don't even see the shape of those baits, but you see that belly sack, that line, that eye. So when I make small baits that are translucent, I am a stickler on it, putting every little identifiable feature that I can that stands out in the natural on that little fly. That's smaller. That's the surf candies. Okay, so then it's a little different game. But once they get bigger, then my main concern is just give me that shape and size. I should be good to go. Okay. But that's not all you worry about either now. I say in my book, I say it in my seminars all the time, is to be a good observer. Watch your baits, okay? And you make flies accordingly. I've seen guys make imitations of certain baits, but the fly, these baits that they're mimicking, spend most of their time evading the predators from the surface. Yet these flies that they make sink like rocks. Okay, now a case in point is a mullet. Mullet, whenever they're fleeing from a predator, they gather in thick schools, they get up to the surface, and they jump. They swim crazy. They're strong swimmers, but they can jump. And then when they jump out of the water, a bait that's only maybe 6 or 8 inches long can jump 3, 4, 5 feet out of the water. And that's how they get away from them. So if I'm trying to imitate that bait, I want that bait to be staying near the surface. And I'm going to give them an imitation that can't fly, so they're going to easily eat it. But at least it's in the zone where they're expecting these baits to be.
Right.
And, you know, if that's another thing. Again, it all comes through observation. Check that out. See how they swim. Do they swim erratically so that you'll know what kind of retrieve to put in? Are they fast swimmers, slow swimmers? Do they stay near the bottom? You know, all these things that you have to consider. There's a lot to it. It's not just making a fly. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why it, you know, when you get these mountain folk from out here in Colorado down to the sea, you know, we have to deal with all these things that we're not used to seeing or observing or whatever. And
yeah,
that's what it really takes to get a guide to help you out, you know.
Oh, absolutely. But you know what, too? A good fisherman in the mountains is going to be a good fisherman in the surf and vice versa. Because they are already observers. They don't take anything for granted. They're observers. They're checking things out. Little things mean a lot. And they're already in tune to that. So when they make the transition, they come down to the surf, it's not going to take me, I'm not going to have to repeat things to somebody. They're either going to see it on their own and make their own observation, or I'm going to tell them once and say, yeah, well, that makes sense, and that's it. Then you go on to the next factor, and then before you know it, they're very proficient at it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's really fishing, and it's, like I said to a lot of people, just trust your instincts.
Yeah.
Don't look, it really is very important. So.
Yeah. Let's take another quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk some more.
Okay.
Captain Bob Jaspers of Flatstime Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you can sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flatstime Charters today and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bob Popovics about saltwater fly design techniques. If you'd like to ask a question, just go to our homepage at Ask About Fly Fishing and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, Bob. Well, you kind of answered, I think one of my questions, which was, what's your approach to becoming a better fly designer? And I'm getting a picture of observation and then correlation, right?
Right.
Of what you're seeing and then trying to duplicate that. What about 3D design? Is that important to you in the way that you tie flies?
Yes, it is. It was a fly that I designed after a few designs already. I had, you know, been doing things and successfully, but all of a sudden I just, you know, it just made sense to me. I would put things in my hand and I'd say they're flat, like a deceiver was flat. And the bait that I'm trying to imitate is not flat in my hand. I mean, really flat, just feathers and some bucktail shroud. So, you know what, Janet, it doesn't have that, really, the heft. I see these fish, I can see the shapes in the water. And I got to see, what does this bait fish look like from the fish's attack angle, which was usually below, okay, and behind a bait fish. So why am I always imitating something from what I see from my side? That sits on the vise. There's the hook in the vise, and everybody makes that fly at that view. They don't, you know, even before rotating vise, they don't turn it, they don't see it, they don't look at the fly from different angles. They just complete the fly as they see it sitting straight in front of them flat. Mm-hmm. I said, no, I want that fly. How's that fly look? Well, I lift it up and above my head, and I say, well, this is where the fish is going to see it in the water. And that's too flat. Now I still want the shoulders in the front. So then I started to say, all right, well, listen, by that time I was using some synthetic fibers. And I had super hair or ultra hair. And the nice thing about that is I could put in bulk any place that I wanted, and then I could just use scissors and trim it away. And then I could trim to the shape, the three-dimensional shapes. Then I lay it in my hand, and I can even feel the cutting edge of the belly against my finger joints, you know, on the inside of my palm. And I can feel the heft in the shoulder on my soft palm. And I see, this is what I want. And I can look at the fly from in front. I can see the eyes in the side. I can see the nice belly shape right in the shape of it, all three dimensions. Now I will put these things in the water, and then for some reason now I'm seeing a lot more movement in the tail, which was because there's bulk in front and there's less in the rear. And that would help the tail move. No lip, nothing like that. It was just the water rushing over the fly itself. So one thing led to another, and then, of course, there I go, Lefty. Hey, Lefty, check this out. He was the one who named it. He said, you should call that a 3D fly. Three dimensions, everything, boom, boom, boom. And sure enough, that's how that came out. And what that taught me, I've made my flies with those considerations every single time since. Where before, I was satisfied with what I saw sitting in the vise from my side view. But not now. Everything I do now, I look all the way around, front, back, from below, from above. Okay, so I see all the dimensions, and it's easy enough to do it. Now, with bucktail, and I have this done, I did in Pop Flies, the first book, I did the 3D there with a synthetic. In Fly Design, I did one in all bucktail. When you do that with all bucktail, then you can't trim. So that meant that each rise and taper, whatever you would want, bulge, whatever you would want in the fly, had to be tied in at the correct size. So, because once you tied it in, that's where it had to stay, and you couldn't trim off those beautiful tapered tips. So you would destroy a lot of it. So it had to be right. And that was just more fun. I don't tie very many of them because it's quite tedious, but it's easy enough to take some of it and put them in different flies to get a better look, to get a better completed fly.
Yeah, good. Bill Butts in Springfield, Missouri, wrote in and says, Bob, you are certainly one of the most respected designers of bait fish patterns in our sport and deserve gratitude from countless fellow fly fishers and fly tiers. Thank you. My question is, who, in your opinion, are some of the other top bait fish innovators in fly tying?
Well, I got a few of them in my book in the back. You can see there's Johnny King, Davy Skokes, David Nelson, Blaine Chocolate, all right, Steve Farrar. All these guys are moving things quite nicely. Not all of them are young. They're all well. Davy Skokes pretty young. David Nelson pretty young. Blaine is young. But Steve Farrar and Johnny King are a little bit older, okay, but they're very, very good. They I know that a lot of, they subscribe a lot to what I think, and of course I would be partial to that style. You know, that's what I like. I look for style. There's some guys coming, but right now they're copying only. I mean, they're in that stage yet. But pretty soon, all of a sudden, they're going to have their fly, their moment, when they have to solve a problem. And then you're going to see them rise right to the top. These guys I have in the back of my book with Johnny King and Davy Skokes, Nelson, Chocolate, and Farrar, they're the best of the best as far as I'm concerned.
You have some of their work in the back of your book too.
Because I want people to see. This book gave me the opportunity to bring some other guys out. They've never been associated with a book or anything before, and this was a good vehicle for them, and to keep it like legit, if I will, because to me it's very important to have good credibility. Is you can see the connection between my work and theirs, okay? And that's, you know, I appreciate that, and they like that, and they've then taken their own route, and they have so much more to bring to the table. And it's just like anything else, like a good teacher always wants his students to be smarter than he is. And this is what I think is going to happen here. I like, these are my students. These guys are going to someday be, they'll be forgetting all about me, so, which is the greatest. So that, for me, is, I just love it. And it was just, it's nice to be able to have my friends with me, and these guys are the best going, so.
Yeah, I just, looking at these pictures, I guess it's Johnny King, his squid
right,
fly.
Right.
Boy, those are incredible. Those are really
cool. Well, see,
cool.
Johnny and I always get along. Anything I write to him or email or talk to him, he's got it all filed someplace. And we've had such discussions on squids throughout the years, but we are both fascinated with squid. If there was any bait that I would love to do for the rest of my life, it would be squids. And I could tell you, and honestly, I probably have designed 25 different styles of squids over the years. I've been fascinated with them. So, Johnny, he loves them too, so you can see his work there.
Yeah, yeah, they're great. They're great. I just happened to page by that, and it looked really cool. Okay, let's talk about some materials and techniques here. Christopher Martino in Clark, New Jersey, wrote in. He says, where do you source your material from? What's the process that you go through to choose the perfect bucktails for your flies?
Well, I found bucktail every place that I go. If I go into a tackle store and they got bucktails, I'll go through them. I don't care how much in a hurry I am or whatever, and I go through them. I will look at them. I even take them out of the plastic bag, and I'll handle them, and then, because you never really know. You can't judge it from outside or from the inside of that the plastic bag or whatever it might be in. Mm-hmm. But I found great tails all just about every place I've ever been, sooner or later. The big deal now is, and what's kind of making it hard is, I think if you follow this book, the big talk is the bucktail deceiver and the beast and those types, and their use is of the largest bucktail, the longest bucktails. Not the largest size-wise, but the longest fiber length. And they're hard to find. And now what's happening, they're getting more expensive because they're harder to find, and they know people are really hunting for them, the musky guys, the pike guys, the big saltwater flies. So what I tell people is, listen, first off, for years we would use the center part of the tail up to the tip, and we would either discard the bottom part, which, by the way, has usually the longest fibers of the tail. But sometimes you don't always throw them in the garbage. You throw them in the box, and they all gather together. So in many cases, those people at home may have some nice long bucktail already put aside. Now, the key is, how do you access it if you already do have it? And let's see if I want to go there yet. The other thing is, you could find, let's wait for that. I'll tell you how to handle the bucktail. You got to remind me on that,
yeah.
Roger.
Okay.
Okay, but to find them, sooner or later you're going to find some nice long stuff. You save that. You cherish it. You put it aside, and you only use super long fibers for super long flies. You buy your bucktails. You buy short bucktail for short flies, longer bucktail for longer flies. You don't do it either way. Okay, so say you get some, it's not easy to find, but you can find them in any tackle store at all. I don't have any particular source, okay, but I have guys now, they, hey, Bob, you want some long ones? I got a couple long ones, and they call me up and I get them. So, but here's the deal now. Once you get it, you cherish it. Now, here's where what I've done in order to extend how long I can, or how many flies I can get out of it. It comes down to how I take the bucktail off of the tail. And generally speaking, when guys will open a bucktail and they go, okay, well, we're going to cut so many fibers off around here. And then they cut it, they grab it in their two fingers, three fingers of their one hand, the offhand, and they grab it and they twist it a little bit and get the scissors and cut off at the base of the tail of where the fibers meet the skin of the tail. What happens then, they have to discard, they have to preen that bucktail and discard the short hairs. Throw that out so that they have only the desired fibers. That's the general way that people will cut their bucktail. But what I do, and we got this fairly well illustrated in the book, is because the long fibers are long, a lot of the shorter fibers are still long, but they're not long enough to be used. But those shorter fibers of the long hair might be long enough for nice clouds or minnows. So why would you just get rid of it? If you cut it off, you can't save it. But the key is now, instead of going at the base of the fibers and cut off, you grab the tips of those fibers that you really want, and you pull them towards yourself, towards the skin of the tail. You curl it that way, and you'll start to see that the shorter hairs fall away. Okay, and you can accelerate that by using your finger pressure against the bend of those fibers and get most of them out, and then all you have in your hand is the tips, and you pull that hard against the skin and you cut there. Now what you've done is you've eliminated about 90% of any of those shorter hairs. They're still on the tail. That's important. Okay, now you get better yield out of a bucktail. You only use the long fibers for that tie, say a bucktail deceiver. That's going to be a nice long fly. Don't forget, the first tie of long hair only is that's basically all you need is just maybe a dozen of those fibers. You don't need a whole lot because that establishes the length, and that tip is really the thinnest part of the fly. So you don't need a whole lot of fibers all the way out there. You can add more fibers as you go closer to the head, but the first couple of ties, because you want to keep a nice taper, that's a whole another subject we can talk about, but the first length goes on, and then you do it again for the next length, you would take out of the same similar area, okay? And you do it again, and again, all those shorter, long, short fibers are still attached to the tail. You preen the long away, you cut it out, now you put your next step on, you make it about maybe a half inch shorter than the first length of the tie. So now you're starting to build a taper as you go forward. Okay, but that's how it's done. The way I preen it is important. So that's part in this book too. So that shows you that. Now here's another thing that I'd like to explain, guys, about bucktail, is understanding how a bucktail is like, how it's made up. We think that all these hairs are growing together. You have the brown, and then right there where it goes to white, here's what happens. The brown is the shortest of the hair on the tail. The white that is right adjacent to the brown is the shortest of the white. It's slightly longer than the brown, or maybe the same size as the brown. As you get further away from the brown into the white, the fibers get longer and then longer. Maybe four times they get longer than the first growth of white alongside the brown. Do you follow me on that, Roger, or is that pretty clear? Okay, so in other words, we've got the brown. You pull the brown away, and then you see there's the first series of white. So what they're doing is they're growing at lengths longer as they get away from the brown. They're not where the longest fibers are going to be directly opposite the brown before the bone is taken out of the tail. And once you have that, you don't have short hairs in amongst the long. They're not growing. Three different lengths are not growing all together randomly. They're laid out that way. Okay, they grow systematically out. Now, here's the thing that's about that. If you know that, if I go to a trip and a guy says, oh, we need all big flies. Okay, so I bring this beautiful big tail with me. They get up there and say, oh, the big baits have moved out. We got all small stuff, inch, two-inch stuff. Oh, what are you going to do? I got this length buck. I got a bucktail that might be 7-8 inches long, legitimate. And I said, well, what am I going to do? Well, if I go in there, knowing how I know that bucktail is grown, I can pull away the brown, get in there, and grab the shortest white out of there and make my smaller flies out of that. Mm-hmm. But if I have my druthers, then I'm buying short bucktail for short flies, long bucktail for long flies.
Yeah, because you want to.
But you can get away. If you understand how bucktail grows on that tail, that's something people don't know.
And yeah, no, like, that's very informative.
And Roger, some tails illustrate that better than others. So if they have some tails at home, tell them to check that out. But if it's not one, doesn't really show it that well, but try another tail and they may see it a lot easier.
Henry in Atlanta, Georgia wrote in. He was asking about the same thing. And his comment was, do you ever find a purpose for the fibers near the bottom of the tail, which is what you were just talking about. Yeah, you're going to
get those. Yeah. But you know what you do. See, now don't forget, I'm only throwing. Where it happens that when they get down to the bottom, or I generally say towards the bottom, some of the hair that I get is really, really good. Even the long fibers are fine, and they're not that fly away. But what makes that really fly away, they are more, I don't know if there's air in them or whatever. I don't know how true that is, but they flare too much if you pull it tight. But usually, that's when you use too many fibers. Okay? So if I'm taking those, I'm preening from the tip, pulling back, I'm putting on just those, I pull whatever short hairs are left, I throw them out then. Then I put it on the hook, I tie it 1, 2, 3 wraps real light, push the fibers around, equally around the shank of the hook, under those 3 wraps, and then I just secure it slightly, and they don't flare. If I had 35, or say 25 fibers instead of 12, it may have a tendency to flare. So by just using a little allows me to have better control of that flare too. So.
And Henry was asking about the suppleness of the hair. He said he found that the longer ones were more coarse than the shorter ones. And
does that make
much difference to you?
No, you know, all the tails that I go through, Roger, I have some incredible tails, long fibers, and they're all a little bit different. They're almost like a fingerprint. There's no two exactly the same. But I've had long fibers all the way down to the bottom, soft as could be, and fine. Then I've had them very stiff. I've had some really nice bucktails with stiff, thick fibers that I really don't really use that much. But you'll find all kinds. That's why you have to take them out of packages. You check that texture. Is this the texture that you like? Is it too wavy, or is it too narrow, or, I mean, too thin? See, when I look for flies, I know the patterns that I need. I know the baits that I'm going to encounter during the season. Now, coming here, we're talking here in the fall, I'm going to need mullet imitations, I'm going to need sand eel imitations, and I'm going to need bay anchovies. Okay, they're generally, and bunker too, probably. So they're the 4 baits that I'm going to have to imitate. I have my bucktail ready for all of those imitations. The ones that I don't have to worry about too much now are the small sand eels that we get in the spring. Now, if I knew I was getting small sand eels, I get nice, and they're very thin and very, say, only 2 inches long. I don't get wavy bucktail for those. I want fiber count. It makes a nicer fly, and I want those fibers to be straight. I need them in olive or tan, and I need them in white. So I get those 3 kinds. I get the tails. They're very short. They're no more than 2 inches long, every one of them. And these are the flies, the bucktails that I'm going to use to make those specific patterns. And then for the long ones, I get the real long tails. And it's by specific for different baits that I use. When I'm making mullet, they're robust. You know, they're like a cigar, but a little bit broader. And they're beautiful baits. So I like to get bucktail that has more waves to it rather than skinny and thin. It makes my job easier. It makes them more airy, and then I can achieve the proper profile, you know, a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Now,
but everything, consider everything.
Do you, is there any synthetic material that comes close to simulating bucktail?
Yeah, I think, Steve, for our fiber, I use quite a bit of that.
What is
and
it again?
A lot of guys, okay. let me point out something, too. The Steve Farrar fiber.
Steve
Farrar?
Okay.
Steve Farrar fiber. They blend some angel hair in amongst a kinky fiber, slinky fiber. It's a great synthetic. It's got a little wave to it, so it's got some volume. And then they mix in angel hair with it. It's a beautiful product. Well, they have them in all different colors. So for those people who do not have that 6-inch bucktail length but only have 5, that first step or two in a bucktail deceiver could be a synthetic. It could be the slinky fiber. Because that is just, again, it just establishes the length. And then you follow it up with all the rest is all bucktail, or you can blend bucktail with the slinky fiber, too. We've done it all.
Okay.
So you can do it, and mixing synthetics with the natural, there's nothing new there. Okay?
Okay. And what about some tips on controlling the fibers while you're tying? And I assume when you're saying, you know, when you're cutting and evening out the bucktail, you're cutting the proper lengths, and then you're building your fly up with those different lengths, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. When I said in the beginning, if I want a fly to have taper, and where the taper can be in all different parts of that body, I have to put it in myself. So if I make one length, and then I come in with a little bit shorter, and then a little bit shorter, and then a little bit shorter, and then I can make a fairly simple bait fish or more squid-like type of a imitation. But sometimes I want the belly to be a little bit deeper than the top, or I want it to be more pronounced in the cheek and head area. So you can manipulate these materials, the bucktail, in a lot of different ways, by either the length that you cut it, the type of bucktail you use, in other words, some of it can flare to give you volume and not a whole lot of work. There's things where if I want to do the belly, but I want a subtle, nice little shape on the bottom, I'll put bucktails, I'll even them up, and then I'll put them in between my thumb and forefinger tip. And then I just slide my fingers away. I slide my forefinger in towards the meat of my thumb. Now, what that does is it unevens the butt ends and the tips so that the tips now are tapered. And there's a in the book you could see it. I wish I could describe it better for you. But it gives you a little curvature mm-hmm. to the belly of the bait fish. That if I just put it in straight without shifting that, sliding my fingers like I did, that would just be bucktail tips at all the same kind of end there. There's
right.
not enough of that desired taper in the natural taper of the bucktail lengths. So I shift it, and it works very well. The other thing that drives Lefty kind of crazy, and we laugh at it quite a bit, is and really the big part of this book is when I did the bucktail deceiver and all these flies, I'm a fisherman, first off. So I don't like to spend an awful lot of time on my flies. I want to get my bullets done so I can go fishing and not tie so much. So in order to do the bucktail deceivers, I wanted to make that quicker. So what I do is when I cut my bucktail, I have my thread on the hook. I put the bucktail, I have evened up, I square up my ends on my my bucktail, square, straight, not slanted. I make two or three wraps of thread softly around the fibers against the hook. The bobbin will fall, and it'll hold enough of pressure to hold the material in place. While it's there, I go take my fingers and just push down on the bucktail. And then that would start to move the fibers, equally distributing them 360 degrees around the shank. Once I see it's nice and evenly done, I pull the bobbin tight. It locks it in. The little butts flare a little bit, and I wrap them down, and it's secured. Hit it with head cement before I wrap, and then it's good to go. And that's the easiest thing. Now, in other times, I'll even do it where I'll make a couple wraps, push it down, tighten it a little bit. Oh, nope, I got a little bit too much on the inside top. I loosen the thread and then reposition those butt ends, and I can redistribute those bucktail fibers more evenly to exactly where I want them, and then tighten it. So it's a tighten, loosen, reposition, retighten. And I do that a number of times till I get it exactly where I want. I hope you can follow this. I know this is kind of strange
to talk about,
and it's very difficult, but
yeah.
There's other things. Now, that's 360 degrees around. I can also do it where I squeeze top to bottom very tight, and that sends the fibers out each side of the shank more, mm-hmm. and then tighten that. So now I can get a flatter look on my bucktail deceivers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, then they can even go down to where if I squeeze them side to side, the fibers go up and below. Now I have a flat-sided type of a wider bait fish, boom, it's done in one shot, or even go as far as saying I do it in a triangular shape, three fingers, squeeze the bottom, my middle finger and my thumb squeeze together with the top goes on, the forefinger pushes down from the top, and if you looked at that, if you did that in your hand, look straight ahead, you can see how a triangle would form. And then I tighten it there, so I can do it all real quick. I can make them all real quick. I don't have to do the top and the bottom or the side and the side. I do it one thing. Wrap one, two, three, position with my finger pressure, tighten, retighten if I have to, retighten, boom, there it is, and it's done. So I hope that
really.
Was...
I yeah, hope you really like a
that.
Sculptor, you know?
It's kind of, yeah. Well, yeah. You know? But it really gets the job done, and it adds a lot of fun. When I get guys to do it, they say, God, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's my greatest compliment. They say that it makes more fun for them, and that's all the better.
Question from Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins. And Rick's been on my show. He's a great niche fisherman and terrestrial. He's written a couple books as well.
Okay.
But he's asking about what other materials that you use for your bait fish patterns and why you use a particular material. So you've mentioned, you know, the bucktail and the synthetic.
For our fibers. Yeah.
Yeah, for our fibers.
Other stuff would be super hair, okay, which is like ultra hair, but now it's progressing to super hair. There's also, there's a new one that I like. And the both reason that I use these synthetics are more for the smaller baits because they're translucent. And when you put light cured acrylics on it, like Tuffly, then it gets clear. So that's what would happen with epoxy. Once I put epoxy over these clear type materials, they would get clear. Now I can get closer to realism. Okay, so the name is really escaping me now, unfortunately. I don't think I have it. Let me see.
That's okay.
I get some angel hair, super hair. That's really the stuff that I use the most. It's very durable. That's the other thing, too. You know, you're putting them into these things like that, and it's good to have durable material.
Yeah.
So, fiber is another fiber. There's quite a few. The little fibers, so the synthetics. But most of my synthetics now are the surf candies.
Yeah, yeah. Eric in Avondale, Pennsylvania, asks about whether you've moved away from the two-part, traditional two-part epoxy
mm-hmm.
and adopted the newer UV-cured resins like Clear Cure Goo Loon UV, mm-hmm. Clearfly, and Solar.
Right.
Have you done that? Are you still using the epoxy? Or
I only use Tuffly. I do not use any UV products. Tuffly is different and unique in the fact that it uses blue light, which they find to be much safer than UV. UV is dangerous. We all know the dangers of UV, either on our skin or in our eyes, okay, cataracts or skin cancers. The blue is deemed to be much safer. So that's all that I use. It's the only light-cured acrylic that uses blue light. All the rest use UV. So Tuffly is the only one that gives the tire a choice.
Oh.
And that's all I use, and it works just as good.
Good.
So,
good.
And I don't use epoxy anymore. I haven't since Tuffly first came out.
Okay.
They were the first, so.
Yeah, cool. That's a good thing. Safety, you know, is important, too.
It's everybody's choice on there. Let them research it on their own and then make their decision. If they use UV, please wear eyewear. You know, wear sunglasses, wear gloves. So,
yeah,
be smart.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another question from Eric in Avondale. He says, we often hear that large eyes are better for striped bass flies. What size do you like, and how do you prefer to adhere stick-on eyes when you're not using weighted barbells?
Okay, there's a few things on that. As far as theory is concerned, eyes are good as long as they don't add weight for me, any unnecessary weight. But generally, for all my small flies, the bay anchovies, the surf gainers, I have eyes on them, just that relate to the size of the fly and the bait fish. Would try to make it as real as possible. But when you get into bigger flies, now my beast flies, I rarely put an eye on it. These flies, bucktail deceivers, I rarely put eyes on them. They're big, and it's the size that actually is the trigger. They're not looking for the eye. I don't worry about having an eye on it. Just give me the size and let me go, especially when they're big. When they're small, again, as we talked before, I got more detail. But if you do want flies on your all your flies, well, on the bigger ones, they have a thing called tab eyes, T-A-B-E-Y-E-S. And they don't really make them. I have seen some bigger ones. I think Bear's Den out in Massachusetts and Taunton, Mass. He has them. It's just a prism eye or a tape on eye, and it has a shaft on it. And that's what you would tie onto the hook. Okay? And if that eye is not big enough, you get another bigger stick on eye and stick it onto the base of the eye. That's already there. And then it stays. But sometimes they flare out a little bit. But there's a little strain, but that's really a good way. Another thing you can do is you can take monofilament. I used to do this years ago, and just take monofilament and stick eyes to that and put glue on behind it, 5-minute epoxy behind it onto the mono, and they stay forever.
Okay.
And then another one, you don't see it. You don't see it. The tab you'll see because it's made of the same material as the eye, but if you use mono, you flatten it out or you double it and you have a loop, and you would stick an eye on it, you don't see the mono. So it's pretty cool. And that's light. It's not hard to do. So if you want big eyes on big flies, that's one really good way to do it. You use some kind of an extension.
Yeah.
Because big eyes are not right on the nose. The big eyes are up into the head cavity. They're up and above center, usually, you know?
Yeah, and you've got all that material that you have to work through to...
Yes.
The bigger flies as well, yeah.
But thank God they like them without big eyes, so that's just me.
There you go. Yeah, why, you know, why add
easier.
Complexity? Yeah.
Amen. Yeah. Keep it simple.
Eric also had another question. He's asking about flash. More or less, do you see any advantage for ultraviolet over traditional?
Now, the ultraviolet stuff I don't have any experience in.
Okay,
but flash, no flash, or a lot of flash, I would say yes. A simple answer, yes. There are times when I don't put any flash on them. Sometimes I put a little. I love the angel hair because it fits right within the bucktail. It's that fine, and I like to starve it in there and just give a little bit of, I like the fly to glitter rather than flash. if you can follow that. That fly with angel hair mixed in through the bucktail glitters. It does not flash. Then look how successful guys have been with all these flash flies. So you got to go with what works for you, what you feel confident in. So it's only a matter of putting it in or not, but it's been my experience and what I do that all that flash is not necessary. It doesn't give me any advantage in my fishing anyway.
Okay, I've got a bunch of – we're out of time here, but I've got a bunch of questions about particular patterns for particular fish. And if you have one, just shoot it out there, and if you don't, that's fine too. Carl Wendell's in Denver is asking about a good pattern for Malibu leopard sharks in the surf. Have you had any experience?
I would just say bucktail deceivers, whatever color, nice and orange and yellow.
And Jim Bissell in Cincinnati asked about a good snook pattern for fishing beaches in July.
Depends. That would probably be a weedless thing. Is he into the mangroves more than likely? Or on the beach? In the beach, it would probably be some kind of a mullet bucktail deceivers. Once again, it's a very versatile fly. You can make that to imitate so many different bait fish, from squid to mullet to mackerel, bunker, pilchards, and in the southern waters, you got all that kind of stuff too. So depending on, as long as he knows his baits and he knows the length that he wants, where those fish will be, I'll bet you 10 to 1 a bucktail deceiver can do the job. And let me give you a little tip for a lot of these guys as far as different places and different flies. You take a bucktail deceiver, take a banger head, which is a tubular cylinder, slide that up ahead of your fly, and just either you can knot it so that it's 3 inches ahead of the fly or right up against the eye of the hook or even further up, depending on where you place it. Use that popper head either as a swimmer or just a bulk in front of the fly to give the fly more movement. And every once in a while, you pop it and let it sit, or you pop it and just retrieve it steady forward and not pop it. And, you know, again, fish your instincts. That's a great advantage. I never
moving
leave home water. A couple little banger heads in my pocket.
Yeah, it sounds like it's moving water and creating commotion and so forth.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what it gives you it gives you commotion on demand. You can just move it through the water and then say, no, I got to get, you see these fish are going and there's something that you're doing that ain't getting it done, and you can pop it and that might just be the trigger that was needed. So that's really effective. That's, again, just the fisherman in me, not the tire.
And I got a question from Jay Mirakoshi out in Fresno.
I know Jay very well.
Yeah. She's a good saltwater fisherman. He's been on the show, too. He's asking, what's your best, and this came in on the Internet here, what's your best patterns for Christmas Island GTs? I'm thinking
you got to go with the bucktail deceivers or the hollow flies. He knows what's going on down there. He knows my flies, and he just take them. I wish I could get them. You know, we can go from however big you want them. You can go from 4 or 5 inches all the way up to 15 inches with these. So we got them in a book from the bay. I mean, from the bucktail deceivers all the way up through the beast fly.
Yeah, and that's what
Jay knows that one.
another. Quick question was, do you think jointed flies are important for saltwater fishing?
I don't know how important they are, but they're not going to be nothing wrong with them. What I like what Blaine Chocolate's done, he's understood what makes articulated flies actually work. I've seen and done in my own, that's why I didn't stay with them, because when I would make an articulated fly, it didn't do anything. It would just sit there and follow the head of the fly. But what Jay Fung's found out was how the pressure against the head of the fly of the water, he will explain it a lot better than me, is what sends the rest of that fly moving, as long as you give it the joints. So who knows? Yeah. I'm of one that believes that I have the beast flies that I tied or are still just a straight monofilament. They move very seductively and not overly so. which is what I like. I don't like it to overstate it. I like it a nice understated movement, and they swim in the water like they were alive. So I don't have to get into the articulation of it. But also, if you know me, that once somebody does something like that, I leave that to them, to the designer. Let him take it. There's no reason for me to get involved in trying to do things like that. So as far as to answer the question, yes, it probably will have a good impact on saltwater fly fishing, but I'm not making any of them because I defer to Blaine Chocolate on that. He will take care of that for the rest of the time.
Okay.
Okay, like, last, like oh, my old, go ahead.
One last question from Kevin. He says, I'm just starting to tie my own flies. I would like a simple pattern for Spanish mackerel. Any suggestions?
Surf candy. Very simple.
Okay.
Surf candies. Spanish mackerel, they chew them up like crazy here. That's
okay.
All we use. From any kind of tunas, false albacore, it's all surf candies. And don't forget, there's a lot of different surf candy styles. So
Kevin,
tell them to get some fly foils and go to it. Get some bay anchovies.
Yeah, and match it up, huh? Yeah.
Yes, he'll have a ball.
Okay.
It's
good.
Very well illustrated in the book, I might add there, Roger.
There you go. So if you haven't been convinced yet, you know, you should be by now that you need to get Bob's books and shows you in detail how to do this. We're running out of time. We're past time, so I gotta wind this thing up. We're gonna give away hang with me, Bob, here, because we're gonna give away your book here in just a minute. We're gonna give away a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and a copy of Bob's book, Fly Design. So hang with me here for just a couple more minutes. The Bristol Bay region of Southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to this region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight, so be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org, SaveBristolBay.org, and there you can learn more about how you can get involved. Just one quick reminder before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what'd you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now we're going to give away a few prizes. Winners for the drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing that we're going to give away here, let me fire up my database here, is the 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So great organization to support and be part of, and this gives someone a chance here tonight to be part of that at no cost. And our winner for that is Martin Diach in Missouri. So, Martin, I probably destroyed your last name, but that's nothing new around here. So, but anyway, congratulations and winning that membership, and I'll get with you after the show and get you set up with that. And then the next thing we'll give away is a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And to find out more about that publication and other publications and books, go to amatobooks.com, amatobooks.com. And let me get the winner for that. Trisha Funkhauser in Idaho. So, Trisha, we'll get you a subscription to that Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And congratulations on winning that. All right. Bob's book, Fly Design. All the answers to all the questions we asked tonight are in there, pretty much. So let's – I'm trying to clear my queue here, Bob, and then we'll question. So the question is, what is the impetus and the inspiration that causes Bob to create a new design?
That's a pretty easy one for him, I'm sure.
Yeah, should be.
I hope.
So they, and we got a winner here.
There you go.
To solve a problem. And I
there
think
you
that's
go.
It, right?
That's it.
So,
glad we at least made that point tonight, right?
Yeah, so Dean, you winner again. And Dean, you know the routine. Dean has won a number of things. He pays attention and takes good notes. Or
there you
a,
go.
You know, a mind like a bear trap to grab all this information. But, yeah, in, out in, and he's in Massachusetts, so he'll make good use of these flies up there.
All right, very good.
The surf up there, so good. Congratulations, Dean. Bob, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. A really pleasure talking with you and picking your brain, and you're a lot of fun to talk to, too. So.
Well, I enjoyed it very, very much. I mean, that's a long time we were on there, and it flew by for me. I really appreciate it. He asked me to come on. It was a pleasure for me.
Yeah, and I know we just kind of, you know, nicked the surface of the whole thing, but you got to start somewhere and dive in, right, and get that experience.
You can't get 40-some years of this all out in 1 hour, you know. So.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you
but
so much.
But get the book, and they can find it. They can read it at their own pace. It's mostly all in there.
Yeah, great. Well, folks, our next broadcast will be on September 7th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we're going to interview Tom Baltz. And topic for the show will be Pennsylvania Trio, the Latorte, Yellow Britches, and Big Spring Creeks. So we're going to talk about Tom's home turf there. He's been living and fishing in that limestone valleys of south central Pennsylvania for the past 40 years. And the Latorte, the Yellow Britches, the Big Spring Creeks are just a few minutes from his home. So he's had an opportunity to really understand and fish them to perfection. So he's fished along some of the most notable fly fishers of our time, Vince Marinaro and Charlie Fox. So listen in to hear Tom give you a tour of these great creeks and tips on how to fish them. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, the Motto Books, Stackpole Books, Watermaster, Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.